Oh. Hey, y'all, my name's Jennifer Huddleston Kelly, and I am an alcoholic. I haven't kept sober since December 5th of 92, and that's my miracle, and the Legacy Group in Plano, Texas is my home group. And it's an honor and privilege to get to be here. This is so fun. I mean, it has been up until right now. See, there are people here that I love and admire, and I care what they think, and I'm not allowed to lie. And so I'm a little twitchy, I'm a little bit nervous, and I'm hoping God's going to kick in just any second now. But I really do appreciate the invitation. I would love to talk and qualify myself as an alcoholic, but I got some hunky-chunky steps to do here, and so I don't have that kind of time. So I'll give you the Reader's Digest condensed version. I drank like a lot, and from that time I tried it until that time I quit, I was drinking. And I was a daily drinker and a daily drunk. And I used to tell you what happened was I got a felony DWI, but that's, I mean, that is true. I mean, why would you quit before you got a felony? But it was actually the drinking that I did after I got that that convinced me I can't quit drinking on my own. I had told myself some pretty stories about when it stops being fun, I'll stop doing it. I got a relationship history that'll tell you that's not true. Whew, you got to quit me because I can't quit you. And that's kind of what I discovered with alcohol, was I couldn't just decide and be done. I will drink against my will. And I've done it over and over and over again. And it was happening all along, but I didn't see that until the very end when I looked down and I had been drinking and I had made a decision not to drink that day. And I don't remember taking the drink. I just remember that I drank. And that scared me to death, and it still does today, because I'm capable of suddenly the thought. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know you could go anywhere else. I certainly didn't have any money or any insurance. So I stalked you. I circled an AA group for a hot minute. I didn't need a schedule, because I knew when the people with the styrofoam cups went in, and I knew when the people with the styrofoam cups came out. And I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on December 4th of 1992. I claimed December 5th as my sobriety date because I couldn't tell time. And for like 2 years, I said it was the 5th, and then I didn't want you to think I was tricking. And so I came in, and I got a sponsor just because I got bullied into it. You know, I went to a lot of meetings because I fell in love with you people right away. You were super kind, and you're my people. I mean, you just are. I can remember calling a girlfriend and saying, they're just like us. And she said, who do you think went to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I was like, I don't know. Like, they tell the same jokes, and they laugh at the same stuff, and they're totally weird, and it's just like the people I drank with. It was crazy. And for some reason, that was a really novel idea that y'all were my people. But I got this sponsor because I fell in love with you guys, and you would not leave me alone about, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. You'll get drunk with no one else. Get a sponsor, get a sponsor. And I used the information I had, which was not much, to pick my first sponsor, which is fine. That's how we all get one, you know. First, they told me to find somebody I could relate to. I think that's a dumb thing to tell a newcomer. Because I am crazy, and I am twitching, and I am, I got 47 voices talking in my head at once, and I'm looking for a sponsor. And, daggum. The first girl I asked to be my sponsor, because I could relate to her, had 3 days of sobriety. Oops. The rest of y'all, I could not relate to at all because you had the hygiene thing down. You had a car with no dents in it, you know. You went to work like every day and so rigid. And and you look like nice ladies. The women in my group look like nice ladies, and I knew I wasn't a nice lady. There was no way. And so I didn't know I was going to weep this early. I chose I mean, I knew it was coming, but I didn't know it was coming. Now, the first lady that I chose to be my sponsor, I chose because she was a nice lady, and that's what I wanted. That's the most I thought I could ask of Alcoholics Anonymous, was that it might be able to turn me into a nice lady. And what I didn't know was she had multiple years of sobriety, and she hadn't worked all 12 steps. She didn't know how. Nobody taught her, and I don't know that she had the willingness, quite frankly. She had a secret that she had been hanging on to. I learned it later because she drank over it. But it didn't matter. She gave me things to do. She taught me about the culture in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there is a culture here, and we don't learn it unless somebody teaches us. And before I dive into 4 and 5, I'm going to tell you what got me willing to do 4 and 5. My sponsor used to make me pick up this girl, Janet. Sweet Jesus, y'all got a Janet. Every group has a Janet. And before I launch into this story, because it's going to sound ugly, I was new, and Janet is one of my greatest teachers, and I will fight to the death for the right of somebody like Janet to be in our meetings. But Janet was cuckoo panties. She had problems other than alcoholism, and they were all busy, and my sponsor made me pick up Janet from another planet and bring her to every flippin' meeting. And Janet had, I believe she had experienced electroshock therapy. And for those of you who don't know what that is, it takes away your short-term memory. It's kind of like induced dementia. And so she couldn't remember stuff. And that makes for a fun car ride. So I would pick up Janet, and Janet would say, "How old are you?" And I'd say, "I'm 26, Janet." And she'd say, "Really?" And then we'd drive, you know, another block, and she'd say, "Hey, Jennifer." And I'd say, "Yeah." And she'd say, "How old are you?" I'm like, 26, Janet. And then she would change the radio station, and I'm an alcoholic. Don't touch my things. And then we'd pull into the parking lot, and she'd say, "Jennifer, how old are you?" And I'm older now, Janet. I'm 26. 26. And I don't know why I had to bring her to the meeting, because Janet could not sit still. I mean, it was like Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. She had this giant bag. Oh, my God. And it was like Mary Poppins. She was pulling crap out of her bag the whole meeting. And fruit cups and a feather boa and God knows what. It was all in her bag. And here's how I knew you guys weren't right. God dang, Janet is doing her whole routine, and y'all just went right on with the meeting. Just, and I'm like, somebody needs to help me. I can't hear a word y'all are saying, because I'm just like, what the heck is she doing now? And y'all, I am prone to exaggeration, but this is a God's honest hand on the big book. Here is one of the things that happened in that meeting. Janet shaved her legs. Wait for it. She shaved her legs with shaving cream in the meeting. And y'all just kept going. And I would drive Janet home, and she would ask me how old I was, and she would get out of the car, and man, I could not wait to get homegirl out of my car. And then I would go back to the group to detox from my time with Janet from another planet. And the phone would ring, and they'd say, "Jennifer, it's for you." And it would be flipping Janet. And she was calling me to pick her up for the next meeting. And during this time, my sponsor told me that I had an enormous ego. And bless her heart. I mean, she sponsored a lot of women at that time, and I knew she had me confused with somebody else. I wish I was making that up, but that is truly what I thought. I was like, I'm low self-esteem. I'm not enormous ego. And I can remember going to the Denny's recovery unit and telling them. She said I had an enormous ego, and they all just chuckled. And so I'm driving Janet back and forth to these meetings, and I can't stand her. Man, I can't stand her. I can't figure out why I got to bring her. This whole thing is making me nuts. I have talked to people about helping her, and they are not doing it. And I'm driving her home one day, and suddenly I realize why I'm taking Janet to the meeting. I'm supposed to help her. I am on a mission from God. And so I began to 12-step Janet. And don't get ahead of me here. So I'm like, hey, Janet, I got an idea for you. During the meeting, how about you sit down? Like the whole time. And my sponsor says I don't have to listen to people, but I do have to look at them while they're talking. You don't have to listen. Just look at them. And maybe if you'll just look at them while they're talking, maybe something will seep in. And maybe if something seeps in, you can find you a sponsor. And if you got you a sponsor, maybe you could work 12 steps. And if you work 12 steps, who knows, Janet? Some amazing things they tell me are going to happen. And y'all, I saw it. I saw it happen, like the lights came on, and I got real excited. And I did something that I continue to do to this day. I kept talking. Some of us cannot stop with a yes. You know, we got to keep going. And so I began to talk a little faster. And then I realized, man, she is about to become my first protege. And because I could not wait to have sponsees. I could not wait. I wanted a whole slew of minions. And and she said, Jennifer? And I said, yeah. She said, I got a question for you. I'm like, I'll wait for it. And she said, how old are you? I'm 26. Go on in the house. You got to call me. And I'm watching Janet walk in the house, and I'm not being figurative when I tell you that I'm laughing and I'm crying and I'm banging my head on the steering wheel. And about the third time that my head hit that steering wheel, it occurred to me that I have an enormous ego. Because I think Janet needs to change for me to be okay. And what I have been given is a set of spiritual tools that will allow me to change so that Janet can be whoever and whatever she is. And I was, somebody's going to ask me after the meeting, I have no idea what happened to Janet. She was there and then she wasn't. The mothership must have come and got her. I don't know. Or maybe I just got the lesson. Sometimes people just show up because it's all about me. But Janet is a part of the reason that I became convinced that I needed to continue on with the steps. Because I was balking at this one. Three was phantasmic. I started feeling real lightheaded. And but this whole digging up the past stuff, that seemed unnecessary. Because I'm new Jennifer. I've been reborn. I read it in the book. Been reborn. Why does new Jennifer got to write about what old Jennifer did? And I guess I'm not the only one to use that excuse. And so what happened was I got me some friends in AA, and I had this friend named Jeff, and Jeff was a good guy. I mean, he was just a friend. My first year, I had a lot of just a friends. I was looking for more, but God kept me safe with my personality. And but I'm one of those people that people just they tell me things, and Jeff let me in on a secret about something that he was real afraid of and ashamed about, and I was honored that he trusted me. I really was, and we were hanging out in between meetings as we do after meetings, whatever, and we were, you know, doing what we do. We're teasing each other and laughing and making jokes and cutting up, and Jeff made a joke about me, and I thought it was a little below the belt. And so, without meaning to, without thinking about it, without any thought whatsoever, that secret that he had told me came flying out. And I watched the look on that man's face, his eyes filled up with tears, and he ran out of the room, and he left, and I didn't know if he was going to go get drunk. And I was mortified. I was mortified. You see, I always believed that I did that kind of stuff because I drank. And I'm standing in a group of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing that I had just betrayed a friend's confidence. And it occurs to me that I drink because I do those things. That is as automatic as breathing for me. I didn't have to think about it. As a matter of fact, I'd made a decision that secret he had told me would never go anywhere. Right up until I came in contact with a big feeling. And suddenly I'm sharing his stuff, and I hate myself for doing that. I hate myself. And so suddenly I became really aware about why I needed to do this inventory, because I don't want to live the way that I used to live. Now, if there's anybody new here, and God, I hope so, who hasn't done an inventory, I know that we turn it into a big deal, and I promise you I'm not going to make this look sexy. But one of the illustrations that I make about what an inventory is it really is an inventory. It's an inventory. It's just counting stuff. And so for me, it's like I've got a little hoarding problem. And we're just going to imagine that I collect cereal boxes. I only eat three kinds of cereal. I got Resentment Krispies and Frady Flakes and Getting Lucky Charms. And you're welcome. And here's the thing, I collect the boxes. So I eat all the cereal and I collect the boxes. And it's really cool because I got this box collecting closet. When I get done with my cereal, I put it in the closet, but my keeping stuff kind of gets a little out of control. So the closet gets full. And so then I got to put the boxes under my bed, and then the garage gets filled with, I'm not really using the bathtub that much. So I put them in the bathtub, and, as long as I just have a little place where I can sit, I can use the rest of the couch. And the cereal boxes start to kind of take over my life. They decide, like, how often I can go to work. And they certainly get to choose who can come into my house, because not every guy is going to be able to roll with a cereal box situation. It's created some problems with finances, because I'm spending all my money on this cereal. And the next thing you know, I'm just buried underneath my collection cereal boxes. And so I get me a sponsor, and she says, "That's crazy, I used to collect cereal boxes too." "Really?" She says, "Did you know there's prizes in those boxes?" I'm like, "Huh?" "Every single box has a prize. It's a life lesson. Did you get the prizes out of the box?" See, we're not really supposed to keep the boxes. We're supposed to just look at the prizes. I'm going to help you with this whole dang deal. Oops. I'm going to help you get rid of these cereal boxes. But the first thing we got to do is we got to figure out how many of the Resentment Krispies you got going. We're going to look at the Frady Flakes. I still got a Frady Flake problem. And then you're not going to like it, but then we got to look at the Getting Lucky Charms. And all we're going to do is we're going to take those life lessons out of it. And then we're going to be able, you can have somebody haul these boxes off, and they can be gone for good, like for good. And I thought that sounded pretty good. Now that whole digging out, because I kept finding more, it's like they were multiplying. But I did like that idea, and so I got a sponsor. My first sponsor hadn't worked all the steps, and so what I did with her was the best inventory I knew how to do. I did, it was 137 resentments. I told you I collect. I only did three columns because I didn't read ahead. I didn't know there was a fourth column. I didn't write about fear, and I didn't write about sex, and she didn't seem to notice that. I did a fifth step, sort of, we burned it. And all I got from that fifth step was just the knowledge that I had never made a good decision in my life. And I didn't know it was incomplete. I really didn't. I did not deliver. I did exactly what my sponsor told me to do. And I now know that that was being passed on. We cannot transmit something we haven't got. And that was being passed on in my home group. She was sponsored by a lady who said, "You don't need to write about fear and sex." Lady who sponsored her said, "You don't need to." And the way I found out about that was after I worked the steps from the book. I started sponsoring some of the ladies I got sober with, and they hadn't written about fear or sex either. And so what winds up happening is I'm walking around without proper information about myself. I get a year of sobriety. I think I'm on step 8.5. I don't really know. I slept through 6 and 7 because I was tired. And and we burned my my four-step, so I wrote down some ex-boyfriends I wanted to see, and I called that 8 and a half. And and what happened was I went on my first sober date, and I didn't know about my fears, and I didn't know about my sex inventory, and I put myself in a position to be hurt. And on my first sober date, he got uncomfortable because we were in a place where alcohol was being served. He had a sponsor. He went to meetings. I thought he was sober just like everybody else was sober. And he said, "I'm really uncomfortable. How about we go back to my house and see a movie?" That's code, y'all. If you don't know, that's code. And we went back to see a movie. And he started something, and I started to leave, and I said, "I can't do that. This is not what I want." And he said, "That's okay. Just sit back down." And I did. And he began to get a little heavy-handed, and I got up to leave, and he said, "No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It's just you're so pretty." And I sat back down. And the third time, I didn't have the option to leave. And I didn't know that could happen sober. I kind of forget we're in spiritual intensive care up in here, and I got a secret because I don't want to tell my sponsor. Some people had kind of warned me that he seemed a little, but they didn't know him like I did. And the truth was, he was speaking to the fears that would have been on my fear list if I had written one. And so I'm walking around with this secret, and I'm not armed with the facts about myself, and I didn't act or react any differently than I would have if I was drinking. And again, this is one of my greatest teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew that I could drink over this if I didn't tell somebody, and I really wanted to stay. And that man was still sitting in the meetings. He was sitting across the room from me, and I'm sure he convinced himself that he didn't do anything wrong. And because he hadn't done an inventory either, not a real one. And so I got a sponsor that works the steps out of the book. She showed up exactly at the right. Well, actually, I was going to carry the message. I listened to a lot of tapes, so I was regurgitating stuff I heard that sounded real cool. And this lady got all up in my business, and she asked me what step I was on, and I said, "I'm on 8 and a half," and she said, "Huh," and just walked off. I wind up alone in a room with her. I'm trying to get her to go away because she is all up in my business. She's trying to look at my eyes, and I'm not real cool with that whole deal, and I don't know that's one of the promises. So I ask her how you found a sponsor, and she says that the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he is talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer. And she became my sponsor that day, and she took me through the book, and when we came to a step, we did it. And so after I said the third step prayer, we got on our knees, we held hands, we said this prayer, and after I got up from my knees, she read the next line, which is a drunk trap. We thought well before taking this step. I'm like, "We did not." And she said, "Too late. You already did it." And as has already been said, if you think well on 1 and 2, 3's a no-brainer, you know. And she said, "Sit there." And we had just gotten done with the third step. I'm kind of marinating in it. I figure after about 2 weeks, I can walk on water. Me and God, we're tight. And she says, "Stay there," and she comes out of the bedroom. She's holding two spiral-bound notebooks and a pen. And I'm like, "Ruh-roh." And she hands me this notebook, and I know we neither endorse nor oppose, but it is my least favorite color. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to decoupage that right away. And I'm so ridiculous. And if I was unimpressed with the notebook, you should have seen my face when she gave me the pen. It was one of those cheapy big pens. I like pens. I like fountain pens. I like gel pens. I like nice pens. Homegirls, give me one of them big things that you use to snort cocaine through. And she says, this is your official four-step notebook, and this is your official four-step pen. And I'm thinking, that pen ain't even going to make it to the car. And she, it was like she read my brain. A good sponsor can do that, because what she said is, should you misplace the official four-step pen? And this is an exact quote. You can use one of the 25 pens that is in your purse. You can use one of the 25 pens that is on your desk. You can borrow a pen from the group Alcoholics Anonymous. You can go to the bank and use the pen on the chain. What you may not do is go shopping for the proper pen with which to write your fourth step. How did she know? And she convinced me that she knew more about me than I knew about me. She also let me borrow the official four-step ruler, but I was not allowed to take that home with me. And I sat in her house, and I drew lines on pages where she told me to draw lines on pages. And I tell you what, I want to hide behind the columns and the format, and the truth is I'm going to tell stories about myself. So she told me to go home, and she told me to write a grudge list, and it's my favorite part of any inventory. Things are good when I'm doing the grudge list. It's like a reverse Christmas list, man. And we started, she said, I'm going to make this real easy. Just write down everybody you hate. We can polish this up later on, but let's just start with everybody you hate. And that was plenty. She said, I want you to write three names every night. If you can think of more, write three more. I said, that's a great plan. She said, and this can take as long as it needs to take, but if you go 2 days without working on this, then you got to call me and tell on yourself, because we're making a commitment. And if you tell on yourself, then I'm going to give you a deadline because you need one. And I thought that was a great idea. And so every night I wrote down three names, and they brought three friends, and they brought three friends. And then I'd write down one man's name, and I didn't like his last three girlfriends, and I didn't like his next three girlfriends. And then we'd just go through every job. Everybody who ever worked at every job. Their family, sweet Jesus, they ain't never done nothing right. So I start writing down, and I start, you know, creating categories. Pretty much, you know, anybody that crossed my path, if I care about you at all, you make the list. They used to make me feel guilty, and now I know that if you don't make my list, you're not in the inner sanctum. So I call my sponsor up when I've gotten done with my list, and I said, hey, I'm finished with my list. I'm ready for the next instructions. And what my sponsor did was she taught me how to eat an elephant sandwich one bite at a time. And I love the way that she did this with me, because I'd had other sponsors who just said, you know, it's in the book, go. And I don't know why the diagram in the book is like kryptonite to the newcomer. But that's not what this lady did. She broke it into pieces, and she didn't give me more information than I needed, because I'm an overwhelm factory. And so when I got done with the list, she said, great, wait 3 days and call me back. Click. And I'm thinking, wait 3 days? What is she talking about? I'm not buying a handgun. I'm writing an inventory. And so I call her back in 3 days. She said, what happened? I said, I got 13 more names. And she said, great, wait 3 days and call me back. Click. And you're catching on with the pattern. And when I called her back, how many more names did you get? I got 7 more names. Great, wait 3 days. And when I called her back and I didn't have any new names, she said, great, come to my house. And I came to her house, and she pulled out that notebook that she had brought out. And she, without even looking, y'all, she just ripped out a page and handed it to me. Now, I had heard that you got to burn these things. Like, there's toxic waste on these inventories, and they're ceremonial burning. And if you die and you're in the middle of a four-step, you got this contingency plan where, like, an AA friend's got to come over and get rid of your four-step and your porn. And I mean, I heard all kinds of stuff about this, and homegirl's apparently got four steps just laying around her apartment. And without even looking, she gives me this sacred document, and I start studying it. Man, I'm about to have an aneurysm trying to memorize this whole deal. And she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm memorizing it. She said, why? I said, so I can give it back to you. She said, why? I said, well, because it's yours, and it's private, and she said, I don't care. Oh, really? What if I show this to your fiance? Because it was clearly somebody she slept with. And she said, I don't care. I said, what if I Xeroxed it and put it on all the cars at the home group? She said, I don't care. And I knew she was nuts. And she said, look, Jennifer, I've done 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and I am free. This stuff has no power in my life anymore. I am free. This has been turned to good account, and I don't care who sees it because it has no more power in my life. And she didn't just tell me the promises. She showed me the promises because she didn't care who saw her inventory, and she didn't care which piece of it she had given me. And there was a whole lot of freedom in that, and that is something that I have continued with the ladies I work with. I give them a page of my inventory, or I write one out right there, because it's easy to get an A in AA when you can copy off of somebody else's paper, and that's what we did. And so I began writing out this inventory, and so I do the three columns, and then I come back and I do a fourth column. The way that I do it is always I do all three of the first three columns, and then I come back, and I'm setting aside everybody else's stuff, and I'm writing just about me. And for me and me alone, I do not use the phrase my part. My problem with my part is if I'm talking about my part, I'm still hanging on to the fact that you got a part. So what I write is my mistakes and where am I to blame? Because that's the only thing that's of any value to me in this whole deal. My mistakes and where I am to blame. So then we go for fear. And the way that my sponsor had me do the fear list, do what your sponsor says. But I did, one side was just a list of my fears. And on the other side, I wrote, how has self-reliance failed me? And what that is I'm going to look at what I do in reaction to a certain fear. So for example, I'm afraid of being abandoned. People run from me. And they hurt my heart, especially men. I'm like that dishwashing soap, and the grease just runs to the sides. And so it is helpful for me to know that I'm afraid of being abandoned. What's more important is to take a look at what I do when I'm afraid of being abandoned. You got to test them, y'all. You got to find out if you a runner or a stayer. And here's how I do that. You remember that commercial that says, can you hear me now? I got a little variation of that game. It's do you love me now? And you got to test them. Do you love me now? So you ask them about 425 times a day. Do you love me now? Do you love me now? Do you love me now? And that's pretty good, but anybody knows the right answer to that. You got to do some pop quizzes. Wake them up at 3 in the morning. You love me now? You know, start really jacking with, do you love me now? Start a fight for absolutely no reason. Do you love me now? And let me tell you, this test works. Because eventually, if you just keep up the test, eventually you'll find out where the breaking point is. And they will say, no, I do not. I do not know what it is you need, but I am not it. And you win because you know this is where the breaking point is. The problem is that they're gone by the time you figure out where not to push it to. And so I start looking at, I test you, and I lie. And when I'm worried about money, man, I behave for about 3 days. And then I go gambling. And that don't make no sense to people in the outside world. But see, I don't have enough money. Only place I know where I can take my $50 and turn it into $5,000, casino. And now I've never actually won $5,000 at the casino. But see, I got a brain with a curious mental twist. And what'll happen is, my brain will go, I know it's never happened before, but I'm due for a win. This is alkalogic right here, and I got a ton of it. And so I start doing that second side, and I start seeing what the book tells me, that fear ought to be classed with stealing, and perhaps there is a better way. Who'd have thunk? And that I'm supposed to be trusting God rather than my finite self. And at once I commence to outgrow fear. And so that's pretty cool stuff. Well, then it's time for the part I do not want to do, the horometer. Woo! Man, I don't want to do that. Growing up, I wanted to be a minister. when I grew up. I swerved a little. And I still tell myself this story. I was not promiscuous. So I just slept with a lot of people. Like a lot. Jeez Louise. And then I got to write it all out? Are you flipping kidding me? I do not want to do this. But my sponsor explains to me that this is not about who or where or how many positions or any of that kind of stuff. The inventory is just about figuring out what we don't know. That is all it is for. That's it. All I got to do is figure out what I don't know. And man, in this department, I don't know lots. I don't know lots because I'm arrogant and I'm afraid and I can't ask questions and I got to work with information I have gleaned from movies. Not that kind of movies, like Molly Ringwald movies. I mean, I'm more naive than that. I've been waiting my whole life for a man to stand in the rain with a jam box over his head. And I got to figure out what I don't know because I've got sex and love and all this stuff all glommed together. And I think I'm supposed to know how to please somebody, but I don't. I don't. And I certainly don't know how to tell you how to make me happy because I don't know what that looks like either. And I've got all this guilt and all this shame of all these people that have been following around and stalking and whatever else. And it's not working, but I can't admit it's not working because what does that say about me? And I write all those things out following the instructions that my sponsor gave me. And man, I am uncomfortable. I do not understand people who write an inventory and then don't immediately launch into a fifth step. That's like emptying the litter box and then just putting the bag in your car seat and just driving around with it. Rough up in here. Eyes are watering. I tell my sponsors I'm done with my inventory before I'm done. I mean, because I want to get to five. I will stay up all night finishing this thing up because I want to get to five. But my problem was with my fifth step was I had that secret. I don't know, probably the only one. I think that only happens in Texas. But I had that secret that I couldn't tell nobody. Nobody. I'm sure you had a little one, but I had a big one, and like I knew if I had to tell anybody my secret, they were going to have to write pamphlets just for me. But I also sat in a ton of meetings, and what I heard was that if you don't tell that secret, you're going to get drunk over it. And I did not want to get drunk. I did not want to get drunk. So I played this little game of let's make a deal with God. By the way, God always wins this game. And my deal was I was going to go after the meeting. I was going to do my fifth step the next day. So the night before I'm going to do my fifth step, I go to Denny's. We called it the Denny's Recovery Unit. And we used to play this game. We called it the Honesty Game because honesty was so new to us. We made it into a game. And the honesty game was just you ask a question and everybody at the table had to answer it honestly. And usually it was about sex. But that night I was like, I tell you what, I'm going to play the honesty game. And if anybody tells my secret, then I'll tell my sponsor. And if I don't hear my secret, it's mine. So we're sitting around at the I said, I got the first question. They said, great. And I said, tell the worst thing from your inventory. And y'all, it was the most pitiful thing I'd ever heard. I mean, it was just sad. I slept with my sister's husband and they got married. Whatever. I stole a bunch of money from a church. You know, whatever. I guess it was a big deal for them. But it wasn't anywhere close to the class of my secret. And so I was just resigned. I mean, God had a chance. And nobody told my secret, so I headed off to my sponsor's house. And when I got to my sponsor's house, she had a sort of a routine that she did with the ladies that she worked with. And she said, Jennifer, why do we do a fifth step? And I knew there was a right answer and a wrong answer. Y'all ever got your sponsor ask you that question and the Jeopardy music starts playing? And what I do when that happens, is I start throwing out like just a lot of pitches, because somewhere in there I'm bound to get this right. And just so that we can learn about our character defects and hand in hand with the spirit of the universe, new freedom and a new heaven. Boiled as an owl. I mean, I don't know. And she let me go for a minute before she whipped out the book. It seemed like my sponsor had a big book strapped to her leg in a holster. Quick draw McGraw there, and she whipped that thing out, and she said, the best reason first, we may not overcome drinking. Oh, yeah. The drinking thing. So then she said, let's say a prayer. And she was real big on this whole praying deal. And I don't know exactly what she said, but I can tell you what I heard. God, please help Jennifer be honest. Because if she is not honest, she will drink. And she will die slow and painful death. And so there was this really long prayer that involved a lot of honest and dying. And amen. And then we launch out, and I begin to share the stuff that I'd written down on my pages, and I do page one, and she shares a little bit about herself and asks me a couple of questions about myself, and nothing happens, y'all. I don't burst into flame, nothing. I got this secret I'm not going to tell. I'm good. Second one, I start getting some momentum. I'm sharing that one. She tells a little bit about herself. I ask me a couple of questions about myself. I am good. Third one. I'm on page three of a rather lengthy inventory. I read that one, and that one happens to be about how this guy didn't 13th step me. And he hurt my feelings. And my sponsor told me a little bit about herself, and then she asked me one question. There was no bright lights. She did not put bamboo shoots under my fingernails. Nothing. I just began to projectile weep, and I folded like a cheap lawn chair. This big, fat secret that I'm never going to tell anybody just comes flying out of my head, and just because I know you want to know, and everybody else knows about it anyway, I'll tell you what it was. I thought I was a lesbian that didn't like women. Right, it's a little confusing. And my sponsor started laughing. She said, are you straight? I said, I don't know. And she said, well, let's take a little look at what you're wearing. And I had on a ball cap, boy shoes, and men's sweats. She said, well, maybe they don't hit on you because they don't know which team you're playing for. And she whips out the big book, and I'm like, it ain't in there. I'm just telling you right now, not in the big book. I've been looking for this. Not there. You're going to have to call New York on this deal. Except it is. It says that alcohol can render some men impotent. And she suggested that if it can do that to men, it could probably do that to women. And she said it really doesn't matter what the answer is, but you and God, you're going to have to get okay with it. Why don't you ask God what you are? And I said, what if he gives me the wrong answer? And she said, what did you just say? I said, what if he gives me the wrong answer? She said, say that louder. I said, what if he gives me the wrong answer? She said, say it again. And I had to keep repeating that until I heard. I was like, oh. And she said, I'm going to tell you this, and I'm going to tell you this one time, and you can believe me or you cannot. But once you get your answer from God, if it's okay with you, God, and your sponsor, you never have to explain or defend it to anybody. And I did the work that she told me to do, and I did the prayer that she told me to do, and I also went to some counseling for some other things that AA is not designed to heal, and I got an answer. And you may think you know that answer because I am married to a man right now, or you may not. Because I don't have to explain or defend it to anybody. Because it's okay with me, God, and my sponsor. And once I got that thing out of the way, whoo, let me tell you, whoo, floodgates are open. So with resentment, here's what I learned. In the big book, it tells me that this spiritual awakening is going to revolutionize our whole outlook and attitude. And so I looked up the definition of the word revolution, and there are two definitions. One is a change in perspective, a turn, like a revolving door. And as I did the fifth step on one of my resentments, my mother in particular, man, homegirl had never done anything right. And let me tell you, she did some serious abuse. My mother was a school teacher, and she never baked cupcakes for nothing. I know. Call CPS. That's kind of embarrassing. And I go through this list, and she wasn't a warm and fuzzy lady, and she didn't hug me, and she didn't have the girl talk with me. She brought me a library book and a box of stuff and said, figure it out. And as I'm talking to my sponsor about my mom and how I just can't get past the fact that she wasn't the kind of mom that I needed, my sponsor said, tell me a little bit about your grandmother, the lady who raised her. And I was like, oh, she was a broom rider. Like, she was rough. My mother was an only child. She was raised as an adult. She was a latchkey kid at a time when people weren't latchkey kids, and my grandmother was really prickly. Ooh, super. She knew the commandments God never wrote down. And my sponsor said, well, tell me a little bit about how your grandmother was raised. Do you know anything about that? And I said, yeah. She was raised with brothers, several of whom were alcoholic. They ran out of money during a really rough time in their family. And since she was the oldest and the strongest, they sent her to live with her aunt and uncle because they couldn't afford to keep her and her brothers. And my sponsor said, you know, it sounds like she probably felt really disposable. It seems like maybe she lived with a lot of powerlessness in her life, and maybe she was really a hard woman because life had dealt her some really difficult blows, and she didn't want to be hurt again. And so she was really controlling because she never wanted to feel powerless. And so she tried to raise her daughter to be the same way. And so where exactly would your mom have learned to hug and have a girl talk? How would she find out how to do those things if nobody ever taught her? And y'all, in 3 minutes, my whole idea about my mother completely changed. And I could see how much grace she had extended to me and how much she had tried to absorb the pain of her childhood and give me better than she ever got. And she had a daughter who was trick-or-treating for Snickers, and she didn't have any Snickers. She just didn't have any. She had M&M's, she had Skittles, she had all kinds of stuff. But she didn't have Snickers, and suddenly I began to value the things that my mom is instead of being angry with her for the things she's not. And so that was the first kind of aha I had in my fifth step. The second definition for a revolution is the overthrowing of a government. And the government lives right here. And the government lies. And my government tells me that those pretty girls have a better life than me because they're pretty and they're tiny and they're blonde. And they say I'm cold and people leap over furniture to make things happen for them. And I still fight with that little voice in my head all the time. But God gave me some experiences with some of those pretty girls. And what I discovered is some of them believe that is their only value. And my sponsor began to pull back the curtain on my old ideas. And probably the most quoted thing that any sponsor has ever said to me is, "Where did you hear that? Where did you hear that? Who told you that?" And so we began to discover that I got a bunch of stuff going on up in my head that I just made up. When I did the fear part of my inventory, what we discovered is I am driven by 100 forms of fear. And I hear people in meetings all the time say, "I have some healthy fears." How do you have a healthy, evil, and corroding thread? How does that happen? I tell you what, I respect alcohol's power, so I don't put it in my body. It is not evil. It is just not for me. I don't stand in front of the truck because I respect its power. I'm not afraid of it. I just respect its power. I don't have a healthy fear. My fears are all about me. They're all self-centered. And so, and the way that I decided which fears made the list was if they stole from the quality of my life. And so all my fears were about me and what you think about me. And the only one that was kind of random was I couldn't swim when I got sober, because when I was a little girl, I jumped off a diving board. This man was supposed to catch me, but little roly-poly girls in a bathing suit, they're slick. And I went right through his hands, and I drank about half the pool, and that was it for me in deep water. My parents signed me up for swim lessons, and I was real good until they tried to take them floaty things away, and I was like, "Nope, Huddleston out." And then I was drinking, and I was drinking at pool parties, and those idiots, I'd come all dressed up so they wouldn't throw me in the pool, only I don't know who you drank with, but somebody who's grossly overdressed for a swim party, going in the pool. And so I did this part of my inventory, and my sponsor said, "You got to see if God knows how to swim." And so I had to learn to swim sober. And here's the interesting part. I have taught approximately 1,000 children to swim. I just couldn't swim by myself. Oh, no. I taught them to swim when I could not swim. This is my secret. I was a preschool teacher. And I'm teaching kids how to swim, only if they get in over my head, we're screwed. And so the summer after I get sober, I got to learn to swim. And at the end of the day, when we're out at the pool, I take all the kids to the baby pool, and I practice not drowning. Y'all, I still can't swim, but I can not drown. And so I would learn how to tread water, and I would watch that lifeguard. He's 15, and he's looking at the girls, and I'm like, "Focus, Scooter." And by the end of the summer, I got to where I could make it from one side of the pool to the other side of the pool, because God can swim, and the Serenity Prayer is real powerful. The last day that we were at the pool, this little kid named Drew came up to me. He said, "Miss Jennifer, when are you going off the diving board?" And I said, "How about never?" And he said, "If you don't go off the diving board today, when are you going off the diving board?" And again, I'm thinking, never. But I am on a mission from God, and Drewby is a messenger. And he said, "I tell you what, Jason's going to get in front of you, Matthew's going to get behind you, and I'll sit on the side of the pool and watch." And I know I'm on a mission from God, because I got to find out if God can dive. And so we were at this pool. It had a low dive, a high dive, and an Olympic platform, and that's immediately where the children head. I'm like, uh-uh, we're going to this baby board. And I'm in the line, and everybody is 3 feet tall and me, and I'm freaking out. And I jump in the pool, and I come out, and I take the first real breath I've ever taken, and little Drewby's on the side of the pool. And they didn't know I couldn't swim. I never told anybody I couldn't swim. Beware of a little kid named Drewby, because he could talk you into anything. And I got on the van to drive those kids back to the daycare, and he said, "Miss Jennifer went off the diving board today, and she looked like a big old frog." I've told that story for years, but here's the better part. My husband and I, we go to the community pool every summer, because I don't have a body image problem at the community pool. Everybody's there. And mostly we eat snacks and read library books out in the sun. But when it gets too hot, we just jump in the water. And we were jumping in the water, and I was talking to my husband, and he started to pant. And he said, wait, what are you doing? I said, what do you mean? He said, are you kicking your legs? I said, no. He said, are you working your arm? I said, no. He said, how are you floating? I said, I'm just kind of standing here. He said, that's weird. Y'all, I have been drowning every summer for like 30 years. And come to find out, I'm surprisingly buoyant. But what I discovered was that my fear of drowning created the drowning. My fear of financial insecurity created the financial insecurity because I made decisions based on self that guaranteed that would happen. Then I get to sex, and what we discover is I don't know what I'm doing. My sponsor's got to teach me how to date. I do not know how to have a true partnership, and we begin with here to here and here to here. A date has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It does not start at midnight. You may not do the whole process in one evening. And she told me I had to get to know somebody first as a friend. If he was a sucky friend, don't go forward. I've already invested 3 months in this dude. Then you date them, and if they're terrible at dating, don't go forward. I'm thinking, now I'm 6 months into this deal. Nobody's gotten naked? This is crazy. No one will agree to that. Nobody. And then, you know, and she taught me how to do some things in a really weird order. And I began to become willing to have a new experience. And as a result of having a new experience, I got to find out that you don't have to get drunk over things ending, because they end when we're in different places and when we want different things, not because of who we are, but because of where we are. And I began to, when I met the man that I'm married to today, I kept asking my friends if he was different, and they said, I don't know if he is different, but you are different, because I was completely myself with him, and the person he went on a first date with is the woman that he is married to today, and I could tell him the truth, and he's not going anywhere, I hope. But I know who I am, what I am, and whose I am, and it began with this process. I've done a lot of fifth steps because I was unwilling to do 10. We'll hear about that later. And every time I've done it, I've gotten the same three results, no matter what. It was never more profound than the very first time. But the first thing that I get is the overwhelming sense that it's going to be okay, or I'm going to be okay. I may not know how it's going to be okay, but I will be okay. And when I walk into that fifth step, that's not how I'm feeling. The second thing that I find out is maybe I get a glimpse of humility. And what that looks like for me is to discover that I'm neither as wonderful nor as terrible as I think I am. And the third thing that I walk away with is a glimpse of what's my job and what's God's job. And today I'm glad that I got to do God's job. I'm glad to be, no, my job. Ugh! Cut that out. I'm glad I got to do my job, and hopefully I carried God's message. I'm glad to be here, and it's a good day to be sober.
Oh, man.